Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman. This is Azure Friday. We're here with Jay Haridas, and we're talking about Storage 101.
Yes. So I'll be covering blobs and tables because I think you've already covered queues in depth in a previous episode. So Azure Storage itself has quite a few abstractions that they give. It's the underneath storage, which is a distributed storage system built on which you have blobs and tables. Blobs, you have different kinds of, in fact, you have files too now, which we will cover in a little bit, but it's all built on the same abstraction as such, or the same fundamental layer. And for blobs, you have page blobs and block blobs. Page blobs, think in terms of disk, and that's when you would use it. So if you have a VHD and you want to kind of upload it to Azure and attach it as a disk to your VMs, you would think in terms of page blobs.
So kind of random access blobs.
It's a random access blob, right? Whereas block blobs is meant for almost every other purpose. It's cheaper version of blob storage, and that's what most of the users would use when they think about just files one-on-one to map to kind of blobs in Azure table, in Azure storage.
Okay.
And so you have these two abstractions out there. A block blob can be about 200 gigs at most. Page blobs can go up to 1 terabyte, and that's one of the reasons why you can have 1 terabyte disk attached, right? And page blob is your backend to all the Azure disks, and also the premium storage, which we'll be talking about shortly. It has the same kind of, it uses the same page blob as such, but it's a different storage account, and we'll cover more in a future segment. But anyways, let's get to Azure Storage blobs and tables as such. So what I have out here is just a one-on-one kind of introduction to Azure Storage as such. So if you never use Azure Storage, you can fire up your Visual Studio, create a project. It's a, this is just a console program just to kind of get you started. And what I did out here was I added a storage library, which we provide for .NET. It kind of hides all the REST APIs. So all the access to Azure is in, Azure Storage is,
So it's an installed, so it's a NuGet package for storage.
It's a NuGet package.
And it's this
and
client
it's
library.
This guy, right? So this is the NuGet package that I've just added. And
this is the package for storage.
Yes, this is the package for storage. It has, it basically has access to everything. You have your blob, table, queues, and files all in one, all packaged into one. So this library has all those namespaces included in it. And it installs a few more libraries associated, like OData library, because our tables has an OData protocol as such. And we'll get into more about that a little bit when we get into tables. But let's concentrate on blobs. For blobs, once I've installed this package, what you need is a cloud storage account. Think about this as your gateway into storage. So whenever you need to access your storage as such, you need a storage account. And you can create one going into one of these portals out here. I've just logged into my portal account, and I go to storage. Let me just go create a new one here.
And we use the word account, though. You're making it underneath your Azure subscription. So it's okay to have many storage accounts?
Yes. You can have up to 50 storage accounts under a subscription. And again, the subscription is kind of linked to your billing model as such.
And why would I make an account as opposed to just having everything in one?
So a storage account is a scale out versus scale up kind of thing, right? A storage account itself has limitations in terms of how many IOPS you can get, or how many, what's the bandwidth that you can get. For example, in most places, you can get up to and again, storage accounts has geo-replicated versus local redundant storage. For the local redundant storage, you can get up to 10 gigabits per second ingress and 20 egress. For a geo-redundant storage, you can get five ingress and 10 egress in some locations. So these have some scale units, also the capacity, right? So you can store up to 1 terabyte data in your storage accounts. And so you have certain limits on these storage accounts. So if you want more than that, you have to scale out across. You have 20,000 requests per second, rather.
These are huge numbers that you're describing.
Right.
I think it's funny that you call those limitations, but these numbers are immense.
These are immense, and in most categories, or rather most scenarios, these are sufficient. But like internet scale, where you're building your next Skype, or you're building your OneDrive kind of applications,
right,
you need to have more storage accounts than what a single storage account can provide, right?
Right.
Because you want to scale more than that. In addition, there's also another reason. Maybe your application doesn't use all those limits that a storage account have. But you might need to kind of be geo-distributed. So you want to be in, let's say, US to address all your customers within US. And even within US, you want to have it US East, US West, based on where your customers are.
Right.
You have Asia. So we have all these regions that Azure supports today. You might need more storage accounts, even though you're not capping your limits on a given storage account, just so that you can keep the data closer to your customers.
So when you're aware of those limits, you can think about it in terms of geographic location, a kind of sharding as you scale out.
Yes. So most of the customers that we've spoken to tend to shard out their data set just because of either the customer presence or also because they want to make sure that their data is kind of replicated across regions as such. Like, for example, Skype uses their own replication technology to kind of copy the data across various regions so that they can access it from all these places.
Mm-hmm.
And their IOPS are obviously more than what a single account can provide.
Indeed.
So they use multiple storage accounts and things like that.
So once you have a storage account, you get that connection string.
Yes.
And that's what you were using with the SDK.
Yes. So I can go and I need a unique name, which has not been used. I've already created Azure Friday. Azure Fridays, I think. So it says, hey, that's the name is taken. But I can have Azure Fridays 1 and things like that. You figure out what kind of replication do you want. You have local redundant, geo redundant, read access from geo redundant storage, and zone redundant. So local redundant is Azure Storage itself keeps three replicas in a single data center as such. So you can think of local redundant where three replicas are kept in one location in the primary. And then you have geo-redundant where asynchronously, three replicas are synchronous. So we are strongly consistent. And only once the three writes are committed do we return back success for your writes. Whereas geo-redundant implies that we finish the three writes, return success to you, and asynchronously we replicate to a paired region with your primary. So if you're in US West, for example, your secondary is in US East. You don't have control on where it should be, but it's all pairing that we have pre-decided which regions are paired. So you have this geo-redundant storage access. And then obviously you have, when we geo-replicate, you do not have access to that if you've opted for geo-redundant storage. You do not have access to your secondary. You have read access geo-redundant, where you have now read capability to an eventually consistent storage because it's asynchronous, but it's only read access, not write access. So you can, if your primary for whatever reason is not available, you can fall back to your secondary, and that way you can get higher availability when your primary is not accessible for whatever reason. And most of the production level enterprise applications tend to use this just because you get higher availability.
So is that implying, is geo-redundant is implying that you're going to handle the secondary for me and I'm going to trust your management systems to get things back where they were?
Yes.
Well, read access could get me quicker access to that secondary in the case of an outage.
Yes. In case of an outage in a geo-redundant, if we have any hopes of getting the primary back, we're not going to do a failover. It's only when the primary is destroyed do we fail over to a geo-redundant storage. But again, if there's any hope to get the primary back, we do not. The reason is because we don't have a per account.
Right.
The entire region kind of fails over today. We don't have a per account control as such. And that's the reason why we want to make sure that we can fail over all the accounts without destroying their production applications.
So I would write code to detect that I'm not seeing what I want to see on the primary, and I'd go and get the eventually consistent.
Yes. And you also have an API to tell you what your lag is. So you can tell, okay, my last 5 minute writes haven't made it, so maybe I should just trust it to give me older stale writes and things like that. So your read access geo-redundant is what I would imagine most applications would use.
Yes, when you're serious.
When you're serious applications, especially, right? Almost every serious applications that I know of is using read access because it, you can write your application to fall back on your secondary to get that access. And then, of course, you have the zone redundant, which is multiple three copies, again, within the single region. And these writes are kind of synchronous again, and you get back success. So that's the four level of durability that we provide. Mm-hmm. And I can create a read access secondary, and I can say create account, and it just creates an account for me. However, I'm going to use an account that has already been created for this particular demo. Mm-hmm. And once I do that, getting back to it, so you have your storage account. The library maps it to cloud storage account. So you can create a cloud storage account and you pass your connection string. Mm-hmm. So for example, my connection string looks like this. So you have your default endpoint. You have HTTP. Obviously, yeah, we would prefer you use HTTPS. You have your account name. I have a JDemo account. And then my account key, which you can get from your portal. When you do a manage access, you get your primary and secondary keys. So that's your connection string as such. Once you have your connection string, you can now start creating your account. Once you create your account, you have three kinds of client that you can, or the four kinds of client that you can create.
Okay.
You have your Cloud Blob client for blobs.
Right.
Page blobs or block blobs. You have your table client for tables. You have your queue client for queue. And then you have your file client for files. So you can create these clients, and then from there on, depending on which client I've created, out here I'm creating a container called demo, and I do a create if not exist. Obviously, we provide the async await mechanism of things. This is just a simple demo to kind of show what methods are available as such.
And this is making RESTful API calls for me.
These are making RESTful APIs.
But I don't have to think about it.
Right, you don't have to think about it, and I'm just. And then what I do is I do a get block blob reference. Mm-hmm. Like I said, most of it you should think in terms of block blobs unless you're using disks. So I'm just uploading an HTML file with a text called Hello Fridays. And this is the simple program to get you started where you have your first blob in the cloud. And I'm going to run through this to show you some fiddler trees.
Oh, this is why you're not using SSL.
Yes.
That makes sense.
I mean, I could still use SSL.
Sure, and then do a man in the middle,
this.
But still.
Yeah. So I can quickly show you what this does behind the scene for this particular. I'm going to run through this. It does a get container reference. At this time, no requests have actually made across. Get container reference, get block blob reference is not making a RESTful call yet. It's just getting an object. And now create if not exist.
In preparation for a call.
In preparation.
I see.
And create if not exist is the one which is actually going to make a call. And if you go down here, so we made a head call. When you say create if not exist, what the library does is it makes a head call to make sure that the resource does not exist before actually sending the request to create.
Right.
And that's what we see out here, where there's a head request out here. And this is all the REST API spec that you can get for our, it's all open and documented. Mm-hmm. The storage client library just makes it more easier. It passes in the user agent just to recognize that it's a storage client library, but otherwise the rest of the headers, everything is kind of explained in our REST spec. And then you can see the response out here, which says, hey, it's 200 okay, and that this resource exists already. So it's not going to do the put call to kind of create the resource as such. But anyways, so this is, again, I'm doing a get blob reference, and now when I upload the text, you should be able to see that this is the put call for that particular file. You see the content of that file. You see the content length. Everything's out there. You see the blob type, which is block blob. You see a client request ID, which it sends. This allows your application to actually do end-to-end tracing, and this is awesome for distributed applications because it allows you to now look at this client request ID, which goes into your server logs, which the analytics logs, which you can enable for your storage account. Mm-hmm. When you open it up, you can actually figure out, okay, did my request make in? What was the actual response? For example, if your response errored out because there was a timeout before you could read it, but it was successful on the server, you can actually go and see, hey, on the server it was successful, but yes, obviously there was a network error or something of that sort. So things like that you can kind of tell from this client request ID. And so this is kind of your put request, which goes through, which went through to the servers.
Okay, so then you used a RESTful API to access storage, and you can do this not just from .NET, but from any language and any platform.
Yes, we have Java libraries, we have PHP, all the languages almost. Like, we're going to come out with an iOS library too very soon. We have an Android library too to kind of access your storage.
Wow, okay. So we're learning all about Storage 101 here on Azure Fridays.